You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
Yeah, so Daniel, written by Daniel, okay, surprisingly, he's one of the best known figures in the Bible. When we're introduced to him in this book, he's just a young boy. This is a real person. In a real situation, young Daniel, kidnapped from Jerusalem by the Babylonians, taken away from everything he knew and carted all the way to Babylon, along with a bunch of other youths his age from privileged families. Yeah, just imagine trying to, you know, get your head into what it was like for him. He never saw Jerusalem again. He spent the rest of his life living in a completely alien land among people who did not believe in the God of Israel. He had to learn how to follow God in a hostile environment. And so what we're going to read is over these next several weeks is just his memoirs, just his story, what he experienced. Now, there's a lot in here. I just want to kind of whet your appetite a little bit. Like, what? How could you benefit from being a part of this study? Well, one is, if you're following God, there are places where you might find yourself in the minority. You know, we're coming off the holidays. Maybe you sat around the dinner table at Christmas and you looked around and realized, I'm one of a few people here who follows Jesus. Everybody else in the room thinks that's ridiculous. Or maybe you're in an academic setting or a work setting where talking about Jesus is really discouraged, and you just kind of feel like you're kind of the minority view in a majority situation where Jesus and Christianity and what the Bible teaches isn't really thought of very highly. And so if that's the case, man, there's a lot to learn from Daniel's example. That's what really he faced his entire life, was being a minority believer in Jesus or believer in God in a hostile environment. The other thing I'd say is if you have little interest in following God, maybe you don't even believe in God, I would just throw out that could change if you hang in there and go through this study, because there's something in this book called fulfilled prophecy. Okay, this is the notion that Daniel is hearing from God, and he's writing predictions, especially in the second half of this book, about the future that come true. Even though these predictions are made centuries before the events that come to pass, they're accurate, demonstrably accurate examples of predictions made that there's no way you could know the future, and yet in great detail they come true. So you'll have to judge for yourself whether you think that's strong enough evidence to point you to God. But the evidence is in here. And then lastly, too, I just seems like when I talk to people increasingly, just everywhere I go, just people kind of feel like, man, what is going on? The world is coming unglued. There's a lot of anxiety about global events. People are wrestling with their own personal life events. A lot of anxiety out there, and this is a book that can really give you peace. Assurance that there's a God out there who loves you, who's present with you, and whose plans will be accomplished. That is a building theme all the way through this book. So there's a lot here. This is really worth your time. I hope you hang in there with us over the next several weeks. So a little more about Daniel and his times. We don't know the exact year he was born, but we're talking around 620 BC. Daniel lived at a time where two superpowers were in conflict, and Jerusalem was right in between them. There was Babylon and Egypt. Early in Daniel's life, the Egyptians basically controlled Jerusalem. But there was this growing power in the east called Babylon. Okay, this is Babylon, the Babylonian Empire, the Neo-Babylonian Empire, technically, at its greatest height. And you can tell that they eventually conquered Egypt. In fact, In this story, what precedes what we're about to read is the Babylonians winning a huge battle against the Egyptians. And then after that battle, guess who the Babylonians went after next? Jerusalem, right? We can read about this. In the third year of the reign of King Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. So he surrounded the city. And it says, the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the articles from the temple of God. These he carried off to the temple of his God in Babylonia, and he put in the treasure house of his God. Okay, so this Nebuchadnezzar guy, we know him from history. You can look him up in, like, Wikipedia. Nebuchadnezzar was a brilliant general and a powerful king who ruled Babylon. When he rolled into Jerusalem, it was such an overwhelming force, the citizens of Jerusalem just capitulated. Okay, and then at that point, Jehoiakim was put in chains, the king, and he was carried along this red line, you can see, all the way from Judah and Jerusalem to Babylon. So it's, you know, a super long journey. He's taken all the way there, the king of Israel, king of Judah. And along with him, it says that articles from the temple of God are also removed from the Jewish temple and relocated to Babylon. These would be, you know, some pretty famous, you know, gold and silver items. Maybe you've seen this before. This is one of those articles that Nebuchadnezzar stole. Yeah, if you're wondering, like, when was the Ark lost in history? This is it. This is the event when Nebuchadnezzar conquered Jerusalem and emptied out the temple. That's when we lost track of where the ark is. So now, I don't know, did they melt it down? Is it in a warehouse somewhere? Yeah, we don't know. But yeah, that was a big deal. And really the main message here, by carrying away these articles, what Nebuchadnezzar was doing was he was saying, look, my gods are better than yours. You know, if your God's so awesome, He can't even protect his stuff from being stolen. How is he going to protect you? It's kind of like a my dad can beat up your dad kind of vibe. So, yeah, that was the message. And one other thing we know happened is that Nebuchadnezzar kidnapped Jewish boys from privileged families. He carefully selected a good number of Jewish teenagers and brought them in chains along with the temple articles back to Babylon. And we know that's the case because in the next verse, King Nebuchadnezzar ordered Ashpenaz, chief of his court officials, to bring in some of the Israelites from the royal family and the nobility. Okay, so apparently they were already in Babylon. Ashpenaz is supposed to bring them into the palace or into the administration. Young men without any physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace. Okay, so this was an effort to find some young men who could be trained to serve in Nebuchadnezzar's administration. And apparently back in Jerusalem, before they were selected, there was some kind of process. This would be like kickball on the playground, you know, just kind of looking for the cream of the crop to put on your team. And so only the very best, smartest, best-looking youths were taken. And among those young men were four boys that are the focal point of this whole book: Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. These four guys are kind of the who we're going to be talking about over the next several weeks. I wonder what it would have been like, really, to be carted away like this. You know, to be raised as a Jewish kid with your parents, to be familiar with Jerusalem, to be in a community where you're worshiping Yahweh, the God of Israel. You know, just to have that sense of community and then be carted away, stripped away from your parents and brought to this. Okay, this is a reconstruction of Babylon during the time of Nebuchadnezzar. And it was a staggering metropolis. It was enormous. It had like double walls and this huge temple, buildings hundreds of feet high. It would have looked like a city to your eye, and it just would have just kept going. Imagine leaving this smaller place and entering a civilization like you'd never seen before. According to Leon Wood, the city was surrounded by an intricate system of double walls. The outer range covered 27 kilometers of walls, strong and large enough for chariots to pass on the top, like it was a roadway on the top, buttressed by defense towers, pierced by 8 gates. On the north side, the massive Ishtar gates marked a procession way leading south. We know exactly what the Ishtar gates looked like. You can see them. They were moved from Babylon to Germany. They have a museum where they're being held. They look like this. Imagine passing under that gate as a 14 or 15-year-old boy. You know, you go through something like this, a low point, where your parents, God knows where they are. Your temple, it's defiled. Your city, it's totally under the thumb of a new ruler. Everything you've ever known has been completely turned upside down. You think it would be easy to start wondering about your own beliefs? I do. It'd be very easy to go, well, maybe, wow, just look at this place. Maybe they have it right and I've had it wrong this whole time. I'll tell you, we all go through major life disruptions. I know some of you are in the middle of that right now, and that has a way of forcing you to reevaluate your beliefs. I remember this on a much smaller scale. I went through something like this when I was an undergrad at Ohio State. I started out living at home, and I was getting a degree, and I started getting involved in our church. And I really wanted to follow God. And I realized I'm having a hard time doing this by myself. I need to be with other people. So I told my dad, I was like, Dad, I care about you, but I really think it would help me to live on campus with other Christians while I'm in school. And he was like, what are you talking about? He's like, I wanted to send you overseas to Oxford. You've got so much promise. You're wasting your time with all these Bible studies. What are you doing? You're throwing your life away. What do you mean you want to live with Christians? And he looked at me and he was like, you do that, I'm not going to support you. I'm not going to pay for your rooming, room and board. I'm not going to pay for your tuition, buddy. You are on your own. I remember leaving the house later that night just realizing, If I persist with this God stuff, my life may never be the same again. And that is deeply unsettling. You know, I love my dad. We have a great relationship today. And I respect him. And I was very rattled by that talk. I really wondered, am I making the biggest mistake of my life? If you decide you want to really make God a focal point in your life, you will run into situations like this where your core beliefs get rocked. And so this is something to think about. This is a situation a lot of us are going to find ourselves in. And it really begs the question, how do you hold on to your convictions when everything seems like it's against you? When everywhere you look, you're seeing faces that have no interest, no appreciation, no value for your pursuit of a relationship with God. Then what? Well, for Daniel, that was just the beginning. It wasn't just that his country was obliterated. He was the focal point of indoctrination. You know, Nebuchadnezzar, a lot of these ancient kings, we just think all they did was just exert their power. they're just a bunch of, you know, cavemen, whatever. Not true. Nebuchadnezzar and these other ancient rulers oversaw civilizations that spanned thousands of miles, that included millions of people speaking different languages. They had no computers. They had no phones. They didn't have rapid transportation, and yet somehow they were able to control the movement of goods and services and people over elaborate trade routes and stay on top of things. You think these guys were just simpletons? They were more sophisticated, better educated, multilingual. You know, they were way more sophisticated than a lot of the people that rule our country. I'm not trying to make a political. I'm saying you pick any president, and you know, some of these guys we're reading about were just as educated, just as sophisticated. Whew, I hope I dodged that bullet. Yeah. So yeah, Nebuchadnezzar, man, he knew he can't just go conquer these countries and control what's happening. He needs competent people with local expertise who can help him govern. And so he educates, and we really should say, re-educates and indoctrinates young men. The point here is they got to be young enough that they're malleable, that they can be molded into loyal Babylonians, but old enough to know Hebrew and to know kind of Hebrew affairs. He's got to have that sweet spot where he's working with the right people. They've got to be taught the ways of the Babylonians. You've got here part of what Ashpenaz was supposed to do. Nebuchadnezzar ordered him to teach them, to teach these young boys the literature and language of the Chaldeans. So no more Genesis. They're going to read the creation account in the Enuma Elish. There's not going to be like prophets like Isaiah and Amos to read. They're going to be reading the Epic of Gilgamesh, a completely different historic background, new literature, new values, a completely different worldview. That's what he's trying to inculcate in these kids, and new food too. It says the king assigned to them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. This would have been like dynamite food, like, you know, Chris Steakhouse is high quality, Hyde Park. And it wasn't just about getting them to eat some Babylonian cuisine, turning them on to some new tastes. We know from Babylonian tablets that these Judean, this is their own records that we've dug up out of the earth. They talk about these captives being fed this diet. And we also know from Babylonian records that they viewed what they ate as a way to honor their gods. There was a ritual way to slaughter animals and prepare meat, some of which was sacrificed, but the whole enterprise, ingesting the food, was a way of aligning yourself with these different deities. Okay, so even their diet, all of this, the selection, the teaching, the food, for 3 years, it says that this was what they were subjected to. That was the plan, at least. And after that, they would go into the king's service. And you'd think that's enough, but it wasn't enough. One other thing that Nebuchadnezzar insisted on is that every one of those boys received a new name, a new identity. They roll into Babylon. Their names are Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. But Ashpenaz is like, okay, line up. Here's your new name. So Daniel, which in Hebrew means God is judge, becomes Belteshazzar. Now, Bel, that is it's a title. It's the title of their god Marduk. So his name became protected by Bel. Hananiah is a beautiful name. It means beloved of God. But he becomes commanded by Aku. Mishael, who is like God, he gets flipped to who is like Aku. And then you got Azariah, the Lord is my helper. And he becomes the servant of not Nego, Nebo. I don't know why it switches, but that's what it means, servant of Nebo. What would it be like for people to call out to you and call you by a name that you detest? You know, imagine, Daniel's walking down the hall in the palace on his way to Babylonian 101, right? And somebody shouts out, "Hey, Belteshazzar!" And then he's just got to slowly rotate and say, "Yeah?" Humiliating. I remember when Trestle was upset. This is, I don't know, 20 years ago. He was really mad at one of his players. Player was number 4. And not Smith like today, but anyhow, he's number 4, and as his discipline, he took his number and changed him to number 82. And this player had a total meltdown over that. Your name is so, names today don't mean as what they did back then. This is like right down to your identity. So what we're looking at here, this is just meant to convey, these are overwhelming forces coming from every direction to squeeze these boys into a Babylonian mold. And I know as we hear this, we're like, well, thank God I'll never be in a situation like that. Well, let's just think about that for a little bit. Is it preposterous to think that, especially if you're somebody who's really serious and has deep convictions about following God, is it preposterous to think that somebody might try to indoctrinate you? I don't think so. I mean, think about advertising. I mean, advertisers make you feel like what they're selling is scarce and it's limited and it's about to go away. To get you to buy, they command you to buy now. They get influencers and celebrities to say their stuff is awesome. They will do anything to get you, the consumer, to behave the way they want you to behave. They do that all the time. You think about political operatives, political entities, deliberately incite rage and anger to capture and to maintain your attention and focus you on what they are concerned about. I was reading, what do online pornographers do to build an audience? You know, peddlers of pornography. They don't make direct appeals. What they do is they build websites with great content, useful content, and then to build credibility. Then they load those websites with clicks, custom tailored to your interests that take you directly to explicit content. That's what they do. You think you'll never be in a situation like this? You are in a situation like this. Every day, all year long, you're being carefully studied by PhDs who work for influencers who could care less if you follow God. People with completely different values and objectives who have a huge impact on you and me. And so, no, we are living in Babylon in many ways. And so this issue of what does it look like to be true to God? How can we be true to God? And hold on to our convictions while we're living in Babylon. That's a big thing we can get out of the book. One thing that we see from Daniel, this is a key part of it, is there has to be some resolve. Okay, we read Daniel resolved, it says, not to defile himself with the royal food and wine. So he was willing to learn Akkadian and to learn, Aramaic. He was willing to read Babylonian literature, but man, when it came to the food, he was like, I draw the line there. I won't do it. Now, why the food? It seems like a lesser thing. Well, I mentioned before, the food was really directly tied to alignment with these Babylonian deities. And it's the one thing he could control. He couldn't control what they called him. He couldn't control what they tried to teach him, but he could control what he put in his body. And he was like, my Lord is my king. I follow Yahweh, and I'm not going to do something that expresses devotion or alignment with other gods. I just won't do it. He said, no thanks. I was thinking about this. I was like, you know, if I was him in this situation, knowing that saying no thanks to a king, it's like, hey, thanks for the food, but no thanks. Insulting the king meant asking to be killed. I really started wondering, you know, how would have I persuaded myself to go ahead and eat and just kind of deal with this situation? I know, what would have you said to yourself to make it make sense to just go ahead and eat the food? Here's ChatGPT's version of Daniel pondering this question in the palace, right? How about this? If I can just survive until I'm serving in Nebuchadnezzar's court, I'll be in a better position to help my oppressed people. I'm better alive than I am dead. Taking the long view, it would be better to eat this food even though it goes against my convictions. I think that could start to make sense as you're thinking about dying. How about, I know in my heart I'm loyal to Yahweh. Eating, that's just an external action. Doesn't mean anything to me. You could find a way. We can find a way. It's easy to rationalize and loosen a grip on our convictions in order to cope with the stress of living in Babylon. But Daniel didn't do that. He stuck to his convictions. He was willing to die for his convictions. And I wonder if there's something like that in your life. Like, what really matters to you? What is your life about? What is life in general about? What out there is something so important to you that you would never let it go, even if it cost you your life? What is really worth living for and holding on to? What are you really standing on? What matters? Man, if you can't answer what you're willing to die for, it makes me wonder what you're living for, you know? It's really important to be able to ask this question. It might be good to go take a long walk sometime. Sometime now, when you're not in as much of a pressure cooker, and really think through, what is important to me? What are my convictions? You know, if you're here and you can't remember a time when you ever went to Jesus Christ and said, I want to be forgiven, for example, that I see you as the source of my salvation. And I'm not talking about like you promised to go to church or you promised to stop drinking or you promised to make some changes. I mean, can you remember just personally going to Jesus and saying, I want the salvation that you made possible when you died for me on the cross? You know, have you ever done that? Have you ever just planted a flag and said, Jesus Christ is my personal Savior who I need? I'm talking about things like that. Those kinds of convictions, things that you wouldn't let go. Really important, because without this, you know, without these convictions, when our life inevitably does get turned upside down, we're going to find ourselves crossing boundaries and doing things that we really regret later. If we don't have this kind of ballast that comes from resolve, from knowing what we really value and what really matters, yeah, it's just hard to make the sound decisions that we see Daniel making in the moment. Here's Ajith Fernando on this. He says, temptations to compromise sometimes hit us when we least expect them, and often a snap decision has to be made. Unless we've made a firm resolve before the time of temptation, we might not be ready to face it. Yeah, that really is true. Sometimes we don't have a lot of time to build the convictions if we're right in the situation. So now's the time to know. Now's the time to sit under the tree or take the long walk and really think about what matters. Now, having said this, though, this resolution, I will not eat these vegetables, or I will not eat this food. How did Daniel actually carry this out? Like, did he go on a hunger strike? Did he tell the cook, you can take your food and shove it? How did he live out this resolve to not eat the king's food? Well, it says, really, the essence is that he resisted in a very winsome way. Check this out. Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and the wine, and he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself in this way. That's interesting. It wasn't take your food and shove it. It was definitely, he was conveying, I want to cooperate as much as I can, but this is a bridge too far. I respect you and the role that you're in, and I want to do what I can, but I can't do this. That is very different than just saying, screw you, right? Totally different. And not just this, it wasn't just that he was cooperative. Even as he resisted, he was looking for ways to help his captors. This is crazy. Check this out. God caused the official to show favor and sympathy to Daniel, but the official told Daniel, look, I'm afraid of my lord and the king who's assigned your food and drink. Why should he see you looking worse than the other young men your age? Good question. This was like the best food available. Awesome food, nutritious food, select marbled meat or whatever, just the best possible food. And so, you know, the official here is like, why should he see you looking worse than the other young men your age? The king would then have my head because of you. You start looking sickly and weak because you're on some other diet, man, I'm in trouble. That's a good point. And this captor's concerns, this guard's concerns, it's a reminder. As we live and move among people in Babylon, so to speak, we're running into people who have hopes and fears and real needs, real concerns that they're dealing with. And even as we're kind of resisting the undertow with a wider culture, we're called to move toward people in love to try to enrich their lives, regardless of how they're treating us. And that's what we see Daniel do. He's like, okay, I hear you, I get it. So he says to the guard whom the chief official had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, please test your servants. He's like, this is the idea I have. How about testing your servants for 10 days? Give us nothing but vegetables to eat and water to drink, and then compare our appearance with that of the young men who eat the royal food and treat your servants in accordance with what you see. Okay, so what amazes me about this, aside from the fact that a teenager is asking to eat vegetables, which is incredible, is that he's come up with a plan where everybody could win. Man, dude, if this works, if we're healthy, you're good with Nebuchadnezzar, and we don't have to defile ourselves with this food. And, you know, we can move forward together. This could be a mutually enriching solution. And I'll tell you what, there is something that Christians need to notice about this scenario, right? Not just resisting, but doing it without being disagreeable. Not just this is the truth, right? But grace and truth. Not just no, but real compassion and concern for the people that we're with. It's gotta be both. Jesus did both. He died for his enemies. He died for you and me, even though we had, in many cases for us, had no interest in him. He went all the way to his death and spent himself for us. So yeah, what does it look like to resist with a view to enriching the people God has put around us? Great example of this in history is the sisters Betsy, that's Betsy on the left, and Corey Tenboom on the right. They were in a Nazi concentration camp, I think it was Ravenswood. Betsy, unfortunately, did not survive. She died before the Germans lost the war. And Betsy, while she was in the concentration camp, claims she received a vision from God about post-war Europe, where she saw a home where people that were victimized by the Nazis were healing from the scars of war, and a place where where the captors, the guards in those prison camps were also healing. where God was helping everybody that was screwed up through that era of history. And so Betsy dies. Corrie Ten Boom takes that vision, and she starts a home for victims of concentration camps and a kind of a residential rehabilitation center for former sympathizers with the Nazis. And she ministered to both populations of people and went on to be an inspiration for hundreds of thousands of people ever since. That woman is on she's on the right side of history. She when people look back, they're going to realize that was the smart thing to do. And it's because she stuck to her convictions in a winsome way. So yeah, powerful. These decisions that we make in small places. You know, Daniel was a nobody in obscurity, and this small little decision, at least it seemed, to not eat the food, I'll tell you, you'll see this play out in this book. It shapes the whole arc of his life. It helps him become the kind of person that God can powerfully use. And it all starts with this small thing, this winsome resistance. So what about you? Can you take an insult at work about your faith or about anything and then still give your employer 110% and be the hardest working employee in the room? Can you be ridiculed by a family member who thinks your faith in Christ is silly and stay in there with them and move toward them and love them for decades, regardless of how they treat you? That's what we're seeing in this aspect of how he lived in Babylon. Man, and I'll tell you, if you can, with God's help, do this, it's so powerful. Christians are different in so many weird, dumb ways. This is a way we can be different that will really point people to God. Resisting winsomely. Okay, here's another thing too. If you're living in Babylon, relying on God. Check this out. It says that the guard working for Ashpenaz actually agreed to this test. Despite the risks, despite the fact that it could blow up in his face, he said, okay. You're just like, is that really even possible? Would that even really happen? But you got to remember, God was working behind the scenes to grant Daniel favor and compassion. God was tipping the scales so that these guards would go ahead and do the test. And so at the end of the 10 days, they looked healthier and better nourished than any of the young men who ate the royal food. And the guard took away their choice food and the wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables. So it worked. It actually worked. He was like pinching their skin and smacking them and just poking their muscles like, wow, you look great. You can keep eating your diet. Now, what happened here? What was it that made these boys so healthy? Was it the vegetables? I mean, I know there's a new food pyramid out. I'm not sure where vegetable, I haven't looked at it yet. I don't think it was the vegetables, okay? The Jews, they weren't vegetarians. They ate fish. They grilled meat right in the temple. It's okay to barbecue for God. It's okay. Protein's good for you. Yeah, the real story here is that the Lord, in many ways, all through this chapter, has been directly involved. All the way back in chapter 1, verse 1, how did Nebuchadnezzar defeat Jerusalem? It said the Lord gave Jerusalem into his hands, into Nebuchadnezzar's hands. You know, you think back in verse 9, how did Daniel get favor with the guards? God granted it to him. How did these guys turn out so healthy? God made it possible. Keep reading. To these four young men, God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning. And Daniel can understand visions and dreams of all kinds. Not because he was all that. Not because they were so smart, but because God made it possible. The real hero of this story all the way through is God. God, God, God. God is the one who is active and present and loving and concerned in our lives when we face adversity. That's not just a theme in this book, man. It's all across the Bible. God stands with people who follow him in hostile environments. And he'll stand with you. And that is a big thing to factor. Big thing to remember is that he'll always be there. Now, the other thing about this that often gets overlooked, and I think it's partly because we're in a culture where we're so individualistic, is that Daniel didn't handle this crisis alone. He stood and was true to God together with his friends. This is my favorite all-time Christmas movie right here. You know, this is the ideal. One dude against incredible odds figures it out. That's not how you live in Babylon. You survive in Babylon together with other people that love God. You know, I look back to that decision. By the way, my dad capitulated when I decided to move out. He was like, okay, I'll pay for school. It wasn't that bad. And he helped me with my room and board. But I remember, I was struggling with a lot of things as a young believer, still am, but there were pretty big issues in my life. And I knew I gotta live with other believers. I'm not gonna be able to handle this. And that decision to go ahead and live in a house with other Christians, I wouldn't be here if I hadn't done that. I absolutely needed the love and support of my Christian brothers as I went into OSU and navigated that crazy new environment. And you do too, man. You need people. Look at this. At the end of all this, it says, at the end of that three-year time set by the king, they brought them in, and the chief official presented them to Nebuchadnezzar. The king talked with them, and he found none equal to Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And so they, right, together, they entered the king's service. In every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in the whole kingdom. And this, it's not just in this chapter. Next week, we're going to see these four guys facing execution come together in prayer and support each other. A few weeks after that, we're going to see some of these guys walk through a fiery furnace together. It's together all the way. I pity the believer who thinks they're going to make it that far flying solo. You need people. If your tendency is to isolate yourself, maybe you're isolating yourself right now. Just realize it's just so contrary to the kind of life and vitality that we get when we're with each other. So yeah, they held on to their convictions together. Just don't forget, don't overlook this part of the story. One of the best gifts God gives us is us. You guys, man, you guys have gotten me through so many things, a lot of you, and we're all in the same boat on this. Okay, so staying true to God while living in Babylon, it takes resolve, resisting in a winsome way, relying on God together. You can handle quite a bit if you can remember those three things or four things. Here's the last verse in the chapter. Daniel continued until the first year of Cyrus the king. That seems like, okay, ho-hum. Turn the page. Not ho-hum. You know who Cyrus was? He was not a Babylonian king. He was a Medo-Persian king. You know what that means? That means Daniel lived to see the day when Babylon fell. I'm sure as a young guy, when he came into the city, it seemed so solid, so powerful. This whole system opposed to God, just untoppable, you know, like it was going to exist forever, unshakable. But it was shakable. Babylon fell just like every other human enterprise will fall. Every single one of them will fall in the dust and be blown away eventually. And the one vision of the future that'll be left standing is God. You know, the end of it all here, it wasn't Babylon that was enduring. It was Daniel and his buddies and their God. That's who we're hitching our wagon to, man. The Lord. You'll see, he is demonstrably the one who's in charge of history. And so I just, man, I mentioned at the very beginning, one of the biggest benefits of this book is that anxious people can find peace. And this is where it begins, and it's just going to be a building theme as we keep going through this book. I hope you hang in there and stay with us as we keep doing these studies. Oh, man, thanks for that prayer, Lord. Yeah, when we isolate ourselves, then a lot of times we get tripped up, then the guilt comes in and the shame, and we try to isolate ourselves even further. And you don't want that for us. You say we can come to you in a time of need with our weaknesses. And I really pray for that. Thanks that, you know, we may have been walking away from you for a long time, but you're just a short path back. And give us the strength this week to just be these winsome resistors that we see in the life of Daniel, God. Amen.